Greetings, everybody. Nice to be in the home congregation. In the Bible, it says over in Matthew, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. But of course, as we know, it's he or she that does the will of my Father in heaven. We all understand that Christianity is more than mere words. With that in mind, I'd like for us to turn over to Hebrews 11 and verse 6. Hebrews 11 verse 6 is a very powerful verse. It contains a great deal of information. Found in the faith chapter, Hebrews 11 and verse 6. Here we see it says, "But without faith it is impossible to please him. For he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him." Now, there are several different things to focus on here. Faith is impossible without pursuance to God, and anyone who would be serious to do that has to believe that God exists and that he is managing the affairs of mankind and the church and us, directing our steps, hopefully, as we allow him to, and that he is a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. So rather than mere words, to diligently seek God creates a situation by which we find that our relationship with God is real. What I'd like to question and answer today is, how real is your religion? How real is God to you or to me? Is he so real that I feel that I can talk to him and get an answer back? Is God real enough that he is very much a part of our lives? We see his hand at work in our lives. That we know that when we trust in him, he's going to be there for us. There's going to make a difference. That there's no doubt, or well, I sure hope he does, or we need him now, or we would need his direction on future activity of the local congregation or the work as a whole. Maybe we need an answer to a prayer. Is our God real enough to give us that answer? We need a job. We need a breakthrough somewhere else. We need to have just the right answer to somebody's question. We need someone, for whatever reason, and when the answer has to come from him, we need God for so many different things. And it's important that we're able to count on him. And that involves what we see in Hebrews 11, verse 6, that we diligently seek God, that we expect a tangible result of our efforts. This is not pretend religion, not that it was, not that we're just going through the motions, not that we are so familiar with God and the Bible that it becomes old hat, but that it really, really creates big dividends in our lives. With the examples that I will illustrate here, I think it will become obvious how valuable it is to have a religion that is so real, that is so tangible, that the results are exciting, that it would be so inviting for anybody of any age to say, I believe in a relationship with God. I want to have the rest of my life with a big brother, a powerful, all-knowing, loving, caring being that's going to help me, steer me, help me make right decisions, and to tackle some of the bigger challenges of life. I'd like to begin this message with 2 Chronicles chapter 33. 2 Chronicles 33. And this is a fascinating story about somebody long ago who made a huge difference for not only himself, but his nation. And he was so young to be able to begin. In 2 Chronicles chapter 33, we'll find who this person is. And to get the context of what was going on, I think we could go to the previous chapter 32 and see the last few verses. Let's see. Well, let me change that. Chapter 33. Chapter 33 and verse 20. Let's start there. Here, Manasseh, a king of Judah, slept with his fathers. He died. They buried him in his own house, and his son Amon reigned in his stead. Amon was 2 and 20 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned just 2 years in Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord. He was one of a number of kings that turned away from the true God of Israel. And it led to big problems for the country that he was ruling over. And he followed the bad examples of Manasseh prior to Manasseh's repentance. And all the false images, the carved images, the pagan idols that Manasseh, his father, had made, and is what he also served. And so this particular man, Amon, did not humble himself before the Lord, as his dad had done. And it was so bad that verse 24, even his servants conspired against him and slew him in his own house. Verse 25, but the people of the land slew all them that had conspired against King Amon. He had a chaotic situation, which is often what happens when a country is falling apart, going away from God, apostatizing. And so the end result was something highly unusual. The heir to the throne was a person by the name of Josiah, and we see in verse 1 of the next chapter, 34, Josiah was 8 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 31 years. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. Now somebody must have taught him. Perhaps it was the high priest, but somebody, a relative or the priesthood, was able to convince him that God's way was the right way. Excuse me. Don't want to lose my voice from this morning. So anyway, we see in verse 2, he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord. He walked in the ways of David his father and declined neither to the right hand or the left. In order to do that at any age, that's spiritual intensity. And even for a young person, it does demonstrate that a child can move God's heart. A child can make right decisions. And something we've reiterated in the youth camps and in the church is that God's way works. God's way works. Sometimes there are little obstacles, but sooner or later, God's way does work. And Josiah made that the foundation of his reign. Now, granted, he probably had some guidance from different assistants, but he was involved, he was committed to trying to follow God. And if an 8-year-old child can make a difference like this for a country, anybody can make a difference at any age with God's help. So while he was yet young, he began to seek after the God of David his father. And it intensified in the 12th year. He began to purge Judah and Jerusalem from the high places and the groves and carved images and molten images. Would any of our people that are roughly 12 years of age today be thinking, well, that's right, if they made me president of the United States, I would strip those billboards, I would turn television inside out, I would get things off the air, I would decree that everything gets turned right side up instead of upside down, and we'd have a real nation here. You know, that's what was going on. And you know, there was probably resistance. When Josiah was emerging, people probably thought, you've got to be kidding. An 8-year-old? He's just a little kid. You can't expect too much from a little kid. Maybe. Maybe not. Well, now he's 12. What kind of damage is he going to do? You see, when people there's just something about politics and government that it seems to draw an unseemly group of people that are willing to compromise in order to get something. It was classic in the 1970s, late in the decade. The FBI conducted the Abscam scandal, where FBI people posed as Arab sheiks, pretending that they were wanting to buy favors from different congressmen. And so they approached a number of them, and at least 6 or 7 U.S. congressmen and one senator took the money. It was all secretly videotaped, and then they were exposed and dismissed from office. Kind of conjures up the memory of Will Rogers' prediction or statement decades earlier that Congress is the best part of government the money can buy? Well, this was an embarrassment, but there's so much greed and corruption in so many different areas of different governments that Abscam didn't surprise a lot of people. There was a House Majority Leader for years, Sam Rayburn, who said to freshman congressmen every year, if you want to get along, you got to go along. Got to bend a little bit in order to get what you need for your constituents. That's not God's way. God is not the author of compromise. But the people that would think that way, that would be floating on the outer side of Jerusalem, hoping to get a little piece of the action, a little bit of the authority, had to be dumbfounded that as Josiah got older and older, he was even more and more committed. Now it was get rid of the idols throughout the country. And by the time he got into his early 20s, as a young adult, he was taking no prisoners in a sense. We read in verse 4, and they broke down the altars of Balaam in his presence. These things were still on the landscape of Judea. And the images that were on high above them, he cut them down in the groves, the carved images, the molten images, he broke into pieces and made them dust and strode upon the graves of them that had sacrificed upon them. And he burnt the bones of the priest on their altars and cleansed Judah and Jerusalem. Now, he had God's approval to do this. It sounds kind of violent, but he was going an all-out purge of all that was pagan for the nation of Judah. It could have been that some of the priests at the time never thought this day would happen. Never thought there'd be a revival of the truth as we had been taught to understand it. Never thought that we'd see money coming into the temple treasury again from people that are actually tithing again, people that are actually supporting what is right. And so God continued to bless the country. But it started with somebody that was just 8 years old. But you can be 8 years old and have a relationship with God that is very, very real, that is moving, that gets results, that leads up to other stepping stones of decision-making. And here Josiah, when he was a full-fledged adult, already had a well-established track pattern of being all for God, to quote Gerald Waterhouse, all for God and none for the devil. All for God and not at all in favor of compromise, as was often the case in ancient Israel, and we see that in the world that we live in. I'd like for us to go on to 1 Samuel 16, reading a very familiar account, but considering it from several other angles. 1 Samuel chapter 16, we read of the story of David and how God selected David to be the next king. Well, God selected David because he was at least 45 years of age and had 30 years of government experience, right? Not at all. David was a teenager. Was David going to be a success? It depended on him. What does it say again back in Hebrews 11? You know, to diligently seek the Lord. God is a rewarder of those that diligently seek. Josiah diligently sought God. And David was willing to do the same thing. God recognized an attitude that David, a teenager, had that very few other people in the country had. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, Samuel was asked to go and select David, anoint him the next king. And so he ended up coming into the town where Jesse and eight of his sons lived in order to select one of those sons to be the next king. Verse 6, and when it came to pass, when he was with the family and they were come, Jesse brought the oldest 7 sons. And I guess David was discounted because, well, again, he's only 16, 17. What do you, can't expect a whole lot there. I hope people would take issue with that and say, well, wait a minute. I'm that age. I can have a real relationship with God. You can be 16 or 116. God is not a respecter of persons. He's a respecter of attitude, desire, commitment. As we go on in this chapter, David was out with the sheep, and verse 6. It came to pass when they were come that Samuel looked on Eliab. Probably he was the oldest. And said, ah, surely this is the Lord's anointed. But the Lord said to Samuel, don't look on his countenance or the height of his stature, because I have refused him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. For man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Then Jesse called Abinadab, maybe the second oldest, to pass before him. And he said, no, God hasn't chose this one. It wasn't that the person did anything wrong, but he wasn't the one that God had in mind. Jesse then made Shammah to pass by. And the conclusion, the same thing, not him. Verse 10, again, Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen any of these. And Samuel said to Jesse, well, are all of these your children? Are there any others? Oh, yeah, there remains one out in the backfield. He's with the sheep. I don't think you're going to choose the next king from somebody that's tending sheep, are you? The answer was, Samuel says, we're not going any further until you bring him. And verse 12, he was sent for, brought in. Here he was ruddy with, says in King James, beautiful countenance, goodly to look to, so he's obviously very handsome. And the Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is he. Not because of his looks, but because of his commitment, his attitude. He already had a relationship with God. So Samuel then went ahead and anointed him. And it says the spirits of the Lord came upon David. It was an amazing blessing. Now, it was probably after this that he continued to herd sheep. But somewhere along in his past, he defended the sheep from a bear and from a lion. Now that's important to remember as we get into 1 Samuel 17, where his dad sends him to the front lines of a potential battle in order to bring food to his older brothers. His older brothers were part of the Israelite army that was poised, waiting to clash with the Philistines. But the way it was arranged, you had Goliath coming out, their champion, who would taunt and challenge the Israelites to come up with a counterpart. And they would duel it out, and the Philistines knew they had it in the bag, because who was like Goliath? Who was that strong with those muscles and that stature and that 16... I mean, the spear that he had was 16 pounds on the head and was heavy. And all that armor, it was just an intimidation. So the way that was, it was a standoff for about 40 days. And it reminds me of two scat cats, tomcats, that are ready to square off. Usually it's just outside your bedroom window at about 2 in the morning. It's all this, just awful sounds, guttural noises that come from these cats. And in this case, they were just like growling at each other. And Goliath every day, well, who will fight me? Come on out, you cowards, and so forth. And they were afraid, and for good reason. And it was sad when you had King Saul, who is head and shoulders above everybody else, and he's quivering. And he didn't know what to do, so they, postponed it another day. Kick the can down the road one more day. So here David comes, and he's just checking things out here. And he has no fear. And Eliab, David, verse 26, then spoke to men that stood by him, saying, what's going to be done to that man that kills this Philistine? This guy... he's blasphemous. He's saying things against Israel and against our God. Oh, David, you don't know. This guy is powerful. We're probably doomed. We don't have a fighter. And, David spoke to the man again. He said, verse 26, what will be done to the man that kills a Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God. He was riled up. He was moved. He had God's Spirit. He had a relationship with God. And he expected that relationship, and he knew that relationship was real. Wasn't ethereal. Like, well, I pray to God when I have time. I hope he answers me if I'm in a serious pickle. No, it was for real. It was, everything was real about this. He was not putting anything on. And so he heard, oh yeah, there were blessings to from the king for whoever would defeat Goliath. Then verse 28, Eliab, the eldest brother, heard when he spoke unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, why'd you come here? Who's going to take care of those few sheep that you've left in the wilderness? I know your pride and the naughtiness of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle, huh? Well, he's accusing David of pride. That's probably his problem. David says, well, what have I done? You know, is there not a cause? I'm innocent here. And David turned and then talked to another person, kept asking, what's going to happen? And soon, in a climate of fear, it didn't take very long for the word to get back to the king, who's quivering, scared. Had a big inferiority complex anyway. And, wow, there's somebody that's actually confident, that's not scared. Oh, really? Is he good? Is he good with a spear? Who is this guy? Well, look, you just talk to him yourself. So they brought in confident David, and he strolls in, and David, verse 32, says to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight the Philistine. And Saul said to David, you're not able to go up against this Philistine to fight him, for you're but a youth, and he's a man of war from his youth. David said to Saul, your servant kept your father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took the lamb out of the flock. Really got my hackles up. I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by the beard and smote him and slew him. You know, anybody can do it, right? Your servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be as one of them, seeing that he has defied the armies of the living God. That is righteous indignation. And the fact that he was so confident, they kept forgetting, well, he's only 5.5 feet high. He's, 145 pounds of swinging meat here, going up against a guy that weighs over 400 or 500 pounds with all that armor and this spear and protection and years of military experience and so forth. This is a total horrible mismatch. You know, I couldn't let that happen to my worst enemy. Some people would think that way. But David was confident. He kept overriding the protests of the king. David said, moreover, the Lord that delivered me, he's giving God the credit, me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of the Philistine. Saul didn't know what else to do. They'd been, in this trench mode, just hiding for 40 days. And nothing was going on. And the longer time went on, the more embarrassing this was to the Israelites and the more confident the Philistines would be. And it seemed like it was inevitable. The Philistines would triumph, they would take the country, and everybody would either be a slave or be killed. So Saul was able to trust David enough to say, well, okay, take all this armor and get ready. But when David tried to put on the helmet of brass on his head, verse 38, he also put on the coat of mail. It was just way too much. He wasn't used to that. David girded the sword upon the armor. Then he thought, no, I cannot go with these. I haven't tested them. He took everything off. Then he took his staff in his hand, something he was familiar with, and five smooth stones out of the brook, put them in the shepherd's bag, and took his sling. A sling, or slingshot, but a sling back then was a very, very dangerous weapon. You could circle this thing to have centrifugal force to launch a powerful and lethal stone well over 100, maybe 200 miles an hour or more. And if it was with dead-eye accuracy, it was a very, very formidable weapon. and David knew how to use it. He probably had lots of time for target practice out in the meadows there, looking after those sheep when he wasn't writing psalms. So he went out on his own terms. In verse 42, when the Philistine looked around Goliath as he would tend to come every morning, and he saw David, he disdained him. Oh, but he was but a youth. Remember, you can't expect too much from the youth, right? And ruddy of a fair countenance, he didn't look like a grizzled veteran, you know, hardened with years of experience. It was like the ultimate insult. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with staves? And he was incensed. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, Come to me, I'll give your flesh to the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field. And then David countered and said, you come with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts and the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. That's pretty brash for a young guy, going up against veteran competition. He keeps on going. He's wound up. He says, this day will the Lord deliver you into my hand, and I will smite you and take you, your head from you. Oh, nobody ever talks to Goliath like this. Nobody talks to the king, you know. And I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Do you think that that's real religion? Do you think that he knew that he had God's support? How can that happen? It happens when you have a regular relationship. You're talking to God in prayer, and he's talking back to you through the pages of the Bible. You know what his will is. You know how he thinks. You read about it, study it, you breathe it. It's part of you, or me. That's real religion that gets great results. And so, verse 48, and it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and he ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. He ran toward him. Nobody ever did that before. I can remember somebody telling me that when in high school, when he did wrestling, you know, you get so many points if you pin somebody, and if you escape, you get a single point and so forth. And the obvious goal is to rack up more points than your opponent. And he said, I always charge my opponent right away. And they weren't ready for it. They didn't train for it. And even if they were much bigger than me, I always seemed to pull them down within a few seconds. They were dumbfounded that I'd have that as part of the strategy. Usually people couch around, and, you know, they're angling for just the right opportunity. But in this case, David did that. He ran right against Goliath. And I think that is an inspiration for us, that we face trials at times and things that may be overwhelming to us. And maybe we're counting, well, if I can get past it, if I could just get by, you know, and sort of sustain myself. Does God want a family of people that just sort of gets by? Or does he want people that are confident that they're going to charge their opposition, charge against those trials, fight against what drags us down or easily besets us? Real religion is doing that, taking the bull by the horns. We don't earn our salvation, I'm not saying any of that, but as far as changing the circumstances in our life, becoming proactive, this is what David did. Verse 49, and David put his hand in his bag, no wasted motion here, he took then a stone and he slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, and the stone sunk into his forehead, and he fell to the earth. Probably a minor earthquake as he crumpled to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and smote the Philistine and slew him. And that changed the entire atmosphere. People that were cowardice suddenly says, okay, let's go get the enemy. And the enemy was scared out of its mind and stampeded in retreat back to Philistia. It was quite a turnaround. It was the result of one person's attitude. But he was confident. He had seen God help him in the past. And maybe you and I have seen, if we think about it, God help us in the past. Maybe that's a good topic of conversation on the Sabbath afternoon, talking to other people. Well, how did you get into the church? What was it that turned it around for you? What is it that made a church not just an ethereal idea, but something that was real, that it worked for you? Something that you would maybe share with somebody else. Because we can be inspired by the examples, not only of the historical significance in the Bible, but even among ourselves. Another area that I'd like to turn over to is in 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings chapter 5, the story about Naaman, who is a general in the army, general or captain, or at least, let's put it this way, military leader of part of the forces of the nation of Syria. And Naaman was a man of authority, and he had leprosy. And the leprosy was a very, very dangerous problem. It was considered a major curse, still is in societies. But back then, you know, you could look forward to maybe being stuck in a leper colony somewhere, and your life was pretty much gone. Chapter 5, verse 1. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria, and he was also a mighty man in valor. But he was a leper. And the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away a captive out of the land of Israel, a little maid. And she waited on Naaman's wife. And you get the idea, reading this account, that she became very close to Naaman's wife. They had a special relationship, mother-daughter relationship. And we don't know her name, this maiden. We don't know how old she was. But I don't know, maybe she was 10, maybe she was 15, 13. But she obviously had an understanding of who God was, the God of Israel. And somebody took the time to get her grounded in that. But it became her church or her religion. And so it was that she was talking to the mistress. And she said, "Oh, would God, my Lord, were with the prophet that is in Samaria," that's Elisha, "for he would recover him of his leprosy." Now, you don't make a statement like that if you can't back it up. Because what if that was not well received? The next thing that could have happened is that maybe the wife would say, "Little girl, you are so loony about things. That's just crazy. In fact, if you keep spouting off advice like that, we'll have to get somebody else. You're just going to have to be dismissed from this responsibility." And it wasn't a responsibility. But she believed the girl. And she was very, very trusting. You know, not only does God heal, but he has a representative right here, in, you know, just south of here. And I know that he could be healed of his leprosy. Well, nobody got healed of leprosy. It was like, if you had that, that was the worst thing, and you were stuck with it, and there was no hope. And so there had to be some reciprocal trust. And this maid was very confident. And it made the woman think, well, maybe so. And as powerful and as militaristic as Naaman was, he had a way by which you could reach him. He had, in a sense, a childlike mind, because when the word got back to him, he didn't just dismiss it. He thought, okay, all right, we'll give it a try. And the king of Syria said, heard about it, and he gave Naaman permission to go deep into Israel and to be able to find Elisha, and would bring all matter of gold and silver and other wealthy gifts along with him. And so a letter from the king of Syria was to accompany Naaman saying that I authorize him to come on in to be able to have this meeting. So it was that Naaman responded, and ultimately he had his leprosy healed. And there was a great trust of this girl in her God to make that happen. It would be like, to me, this sounds to me like something that Shirley Temple would act out in a movie is when she was small. And it would be sort of like Shirley Temple going up to General Patton in World War II and saying, "Mr. Patton, if you go on this dirt road that's not on any of your maps, you'll get to your destination twice as fast. Trust me." But you're a little kid. You're not a military person. It's amazing when you have God behind you, what you can do. When a church, a group of people do, there's a spiritual synergy that is very powerful, very moving. Once again, how real is our religion? I'll take time to refer to Luke 2, verses 36 through 37, where you read about Anna, the prophetess. This was right after Christ was born, and she was... You can turn there if you wish. I'll just read it. Luke 2, verses 36 through 37. But here's another person that, instead of being very young, was very, very old, but just as intensely focused. She says that she was a widow, or Anna, a prophetess, a daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. This is Luke 2, 36. And she lived with her husband 7 years from her virginity. She was of a great age, and she was a widow of about 84 years, which departed not from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers night and day. Do you think that she got results? Do you think her God was real to her? After that, investing that kind of time, I would say so. And maybe it's not accidental, obviously not, that her name is recorded in the Bible. And that she's, you know, received honorable mention for her zeal. It's tough for people today to match that kind of intense focus. We've got a record number of distractions. Hundreds of radio stations, hundreds more television stations, all kinds of gadgetry. I'm amazed how many times people with cell phones have to answer it all the time. Well, if it's part of your business... It's understandable. I have to remember to carry that with me all the time. There's something to be said for getting away, just like Christ did in Mark 1:35, where he would arise a great while before the day and just get away from the hustle and bustle of demands and activities and communication, whatever that they had, and get close to God. He would pray and rise up early, as it says, a great while before the day. You have to make the time. And these people did. And they have arguably all had less distractions than we have. We can't escape the fact that we live in the 21st century. But we have to do what we can. Excuse me. You just don't know when... You might need God to work for you in a dramatic way. I remember decades ago, we had one student who decided to go to Ambassador College. If you go to ABC, which is a wonderful opportunity, you may have to come up with a couple $1,000s to cover the beginning of rent and the tuition and other things. It changes all the time. But back when this individual was accepted to Ambassador College, you needed at least 4 to 5 times that just to get there. And in today's equivalent amount of money. Well, this particular person thought she counted the cost. And somehow the bursar's office thought that she counted the cost. And she made this very courageous trip across the country to Ambassador College in Pasadena and was absolutely stunned to be at the bursar's office trying to enroll, and they said, "Well, you need a lot more money than this." She didn't have it. And how was she going to get back home now that she made it all the way out? And there were all kinds of other issues. She was scared. And her mother fasted about it, and they prayed about it, obviously. And then she went back to pick up her money at the bursar's office. And at about that time, a stranger came into that room, slapped down an envelope in front of the treasurer, and said, "This money is for Wilda Mahaffey." I'm just making up a name. And turned around and walked out and was gone. And when she got there, she found out that the exact amount of her tuition had been paid. It was covered. God can do that. And not only that, we have one person in the ministry to this day that about 18 years before then, this goes back in the early years, didn't have the money, and somebody else showed up and put an envelope down from the bursar and said, "This money is for so-and-so." You just don't know. Sometimes you need God at the most inopportune time. And it's important that we have a relationship of prayer and study so that we don't have to wait till a crisis to try to scramble to get real with God and Him be real with us. I remember one minister, when I first came into the church, he said, "I got this phone call at 3 a.m. It was a desperate SOS for help. You know, somebody in the family was near death and needed help." Now, I remember, I love this, another pastor saying, when he came to an area for the first time, he says, "And by the way, feel free to call me anytime. Anytime. However, the advice that I give at 3 in the afternoon may be a lot better than 3 in the morning." I thought that was tactful. Now, here it was 3 a.m., and this call was frantic for help. And so this guy, he's getting out of bed. He says, "Hello, okay, okay, click." He's rubbing his eyes, trying to wake up. "Okay, I'm supposed to pray." And then he thought, who called? What was it about? He couldn't remember the details. He wasn't totally awake. But it was crunch time, so he got down on his knees, and he says, "Father in heaven, there's somebody that's in desperate trouble somewhere within 200 miles of my prayer, and I don't know who it is, but you do, and you've got to help. And so in the name of Jesus Christ, you know, your power of attorney, you know, whatever you do in my name, you know, or ask in my name, I will do it." That's what is promised multiple times by Christ. You have to do that, Father. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. The minister used the same phrase that all of us are entitled to use, in the name of Jesus Christ. Over in John 14 is one of the excerpts of the Bible that shows that to be the case. In John 14, verse 12, it says, "Verily, verily, I say to you, he that believes on me, the works that I do shall he do also, and greater works than these shall he do, because I go to my Father." And that's an enormous statement in itself. I think of on Pentecost, Peter's shadow healing people as he walked by the sick. Even Christ didn't heal in that manner. But of course, it couldn't have happened without Christ and God the Father. Verse 13, "Whatsoever you shall ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If you ask anything in my name, I will do it." And I think that we're wise enough, after all these years, to understand that the things that we would ask for would be good things, that we would have good reason to ask for whatever things that we're praying about, and that God would want to honor those. You know, God is so powerful, and it's easy, if we minimize our contact with Him, to forget just how fantastic He is. We can't just know about this. We have to use it. If you read the book of James, you realize that he was anything but a hypocrite. He was one that pushed hard for everybody including himself, to be the real deal, to be real, to be a reflection on the inside of what was projected on the outside. And he makes a statement over in James chapter 2. He's talking about, well, many statements, talking about faith without works is dead. And then he says in chapter 2 in verse 19, you believe that there is one God? Well, you do well. Makes sense. But he says the devils even believe and they tremble. But the demons want to obey God? Do they want to have a relationship with God? Not at all. None. Their actions indicate that they don't. And so even they can understand the Bible or understand the plan of God, but it doesn't mean anything unless they follow it. Sorry. And so it's so true with all of us. You know, people talk about relationships these days. You know, we need more relationships, and I'm all for relationships. I was up at the general conference, and in one breakout session, they had a number of the youth interviewed, and they were all talking about, you know, how can we keep people all together, be focused, and be part of the church. Sorry. And so a number of them were saying relationships were so important, having friends. And I was sitting there thinking, well, I agree in part, but that's not the whole equation. It can't be. Because in YOU, those years, we had as active a program as anybody, and we didn't retain most of our people. And that's true church-wide. We believed in relationships then. But relationships have to be grounded with God. And a lot of times, a lot of the relationships back in those years were with other kids, which was fine, but they didn't include enough people that had committed to this way of life. Iron sharpens iron, says in Proverbs 27:17. It really is ideal what goes on in the camps. I was so impressed last year, and I'll have the chance to be a part of it this year, is that they teach a lot of athletic activity. There's a lot of fun things. There's dances. There's a great balance of activities. But there's good instruction on the ways of God and how God can work in the life of anybody, and especially the people that attend a place like that. And so by putting God involved more and more in these circles of relationships, then we have something that we can get excited about. But we can't have something that's a secular sideshow where people never, ever get to a spiritual depth. And the Bible shows, and we've got examples of people that have demonstrated that people of any age can get serious about God and God can do some mighty things through them. Sometimes we put ourselves down. Back after one split years ago in one other congregation, there was a 13-year-old or 12-year-old young man who came up to the pastor and said, well, do you want the lapel mic or do you want this other mic? And he looked at him. He was surprised. And the sound man that was in charge had decided to do something else, and his assistant had done something else. And so this little guy said, after a long pause, he smiled. He says, I'm all you got. Now, that's a case of humility, maybe. But he was more than enough. He made a difference. And he realized, you know what? This is my religion. This is my church. The God of David, the God of that little maid, the God of Josiah, is the same God that I pray to. It's the same one that I get my help from. And yeah, I'm in. This is me. This is part of me. This is what I do. I don't know what my parents are going to do forever and ever and ever. I don't know what my cousins are going to do forever and ever and ever. But this is my belief. This is my religion. This is what works because I get results from this. Has to be that way. Has to be that way. And it can be that way. Again, Hebrews 11:6, you know, very powerful verse. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him, for he that comes to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. And you can seek God at any age. Not that many people have. Roger Staubach, famous quarterback of Dallas years ago, who added religion to his life, said not that many people go the extra mile for God. He says, so when you get into that strata, he says, there is not that much traffic. So there's no traffic tie-ups, no congestion. But there's room for so many more people. Sometimes when people get on cell phones, they will have sometimes bad reception. They're in the phone zone with poor reception. And that can happen even spiritually. And maybe it's because sometimes people drift from God. I mentioned King David. He was dynamic for a number of years. And then in his middle age, he drifted. And you can drift not all at once, but inch by inch. And he ended up getting in trouble with Uriah and Bathsheba. You know the story. And then he got serious again. He repented. He says, God, don't take the Holy Spirit from me. And if you're not baptized, you can ask for God's Holy Spirit, which guides you, helps you to think. There's nothing more delightful than to be able to say the right thing at the right time. I've had the experience of thinking of the perfect thing to say, but 24 hours too late. It's nice to do it on time. You have to make time for God. I have to do that. I have to get away sometimes. I'm glad my voice lasted to this point. Well, I'm going to conclude before it's gone. Excuse me. Anyway, we have to make the time. And it's essential. Remember, before he was crucified, Christ said to his disciples, the night before in Gethsemane, he said to them, can't you watch with me an hour? He was praying all night. He wanted them on the momentous eve of a major crisis to be able to pray with him. So it was so important that they would rise to the occasion. You can rise to the occasions like that, or the other occasions that we've reviewed, if we're close to God all the time, or strive to be. Again, it's a two-way conversation. We make time to pray to God, and then He answers us in the pages of the Bible. There have been many a person in God's church that wanted an answer to some problem, and they prayed about it, and then their next Bible study or some other time, they just flip through and they end up coming into the answer. It might be in a different way, or maybe through a correspondence course lesson. You have to have the confidence that if you have a need and you're asking God for His help, He's going to give it to you. In the world that we live in, it's increasingly challenging. We're going to need more help than ever spiritually to maintain spiritual balance and to maintain enough intensity to make God happy with us and to get the results that we need to. Maybe you've got challenges in high school. Maybe you have to handle being persecuted or ridiculed. Maybe you're not gifted, you're not good in karate and you can't shoot a basketball. What else can any of us do to be able to walk as Christ did in favor with both God and man? Maybe we have a crisis in some other area of our life, something that we can't seem to get a handle on or overcome, something that is just such a problem. We need God's Spirit. You go to God in a real relationship, these things become possible. It's not good for us to just hold our position as an individual or as a congregation. We can increase the amount of fruit that God wants us to bear if we will yield to Him and His ways, and we will maintain this cycle of communication, taking the time to pray every day, maybe even multiple times in the day. David and Daniel did that. I find, you know, people that may do that may have trials, just as people may have trials that don't, but they seem to be able to be more in control of their lives. And that's part of what it's all about, being able to get results. That's a real relationship. That's real religion. And people of all ages before us have demonstrated that they were able to achieve that. We need to do the same thing.